on this Labor Day, I am delighted to welcome somebody who's been a friend of mine, at least going back to 1985. She is the co-founder of Irish America magazine, and along with the publisher Neil O'Dowd. That takes us back, oh my God, tell me it's not 33 years, is it?
I guess so, Adrian. It's amazing, though. We don't look any older, right?
Absolutely, no.
But think of all the incredible people we met over those years.
Incredible doesn't even cover it. And I think we could, it would be, you know, fair to say that despite, you know, the great spread of immigrants and their descendants, you know, across the country, the Irish seemed to be rather parochial. They were their own clique in the sense that, you know, even taking our East Coast here, the New York Irish pretty much stayed in New York, and right across the river in New Jersey, they had their own clubs. Irish America magazine would, in fact, would change that. And before we get into the significance of the great number of people that you profiled, back in 85, again, you know, we were the, you know, one of the largest ethnic groups in the United States, and still, with the exception, say, of organizations like the Ancient Order of Hibernians, we really didn't have a kind of unified source of media.
Well, it was really interesting for us, Adrian, starting the magazine in 1985, and I know you were at the launch in October of that year, and you really helped us get the word out, and I'd like to say hello to many of our subscribers that indeed come from your show right in the beginning and have stayed with us over the years. But, yeah, we really wanted to look at Ireland across the states, and we really had two things in mind. One was to try and get the word out on immigration, which you were, of course, a big part of. And the other was to try and do something, which Neil became a big part of, and you did too, on Northern Ireland, and try and sort of help bring a political solution along there. So it's been quite a ride. And of course, now we do a lot of events. We have our Wall Street 50 coming up on right. September 26th, Healthcare 50, and actually that beautiful tune by Joni Madden reminded me of our Healthcare 50 because we played it for Daniel O'Day, who was our keynote speaker at our last Healthcare 50 last year, because his ancestors were from Clare. So yeah, right from like fourth generation, like people like Dan O'Day, who's the head of Roche Pharmaceuticals, this huge global pharmaceutical company, to some new immigrants who kind of cover across the generations and also try and bring in people from around the country for different, you know, like having the governor of California at our Hall of Fame in March. So that kind of reach. So
yeah, and it's also, you know, the reach again of the Irish American magazine in terms of, you know, across the board, you know, we have a danger, and indeed we contribute to it ourselves, you know, by saying immigration, that's the end of, you know, the Irish as we know them in the United States. But if you take another look at that one, Irish America and Irish Americans are very much a part of the culture, and there are many who would say that indeed the ethos, the you know, the interest of Ireland is carried on, you know, generation after generation, and we'd hold up with the best of other ethnic groups if not surpass them. There is
absolutely that. I mean, that has been my experience, and right from the very start, Irish Americans that I met helped me all along the way. So, you know, And of course, the history of Irish America is so terrific, and it's continuing on today, you know, and we have that wonderful famine memorial that you were involved in bringing over here to remind people. But you also have, like, this Labor Day weekend, you know, gives us a chance to look at the history of the Irish and labor and all those terrific people who have been involved right from over the start over the years.
Yeah. When, you know, when we look at the labor and the labor movement, most of us indeed have long forgotten, and your article, indeed, and your coverage of Irish labor, their place in the history, you know, of the labor movement, it's incredible in the sense that, you know, we were to the fore definitely in that. Sometimes when we think of the labor movement, as I did at the beginning of the programs, you know, we think of the Molly Maguires, we think of, you know, the Drill Ye Terriers Drill, a segment of the Irish again, significant, but the whole notion of the AFL, the AFL-CIO, and the Irish influence in that is incredible.
Yeah, and if you even look at the founder of Labor Day, it was Maguire, you know, who was just, and you look at Mother Jones, and you look at Mike Quill. I never knew Mike Quill, but I did know Teddy Gleason and, you know, Terry O'Sullivan, and, of course, interviewed Mary Kay Henry, who's now heading up the service employees union and trying to get a fair play for the minimum wage, trying to raise the minimum wage, which really, you know.
And then, you know, leaders like, you know, John Sweeney, you know, incredible influence, you know, George Meany, for instance.
Yeah, and their incredible connection to Ireland that they never forgot. They were like immigrants or the grandsons of immigrants. And, you know, Terry O'Sullivan actually talked about it in that interview we did with him for our Hall of Fame. He grew up in San Francisco. His father died when he was really young, and it was the labor union that looked after him and, you know, gave him a job as soon as he could work. You know, he would work his summers. And so that whole labor movement was like an extension of family for many people over the years.
I think also you mentioned, of course, you're too young to remember the influence of Mike Quill, and
what an incredible man. I mean, he, you know, I guess he died he led that strike in 1966 for the transit workers union, and I know he died a couple of days later after they put him in jail for that.
Yeah.
But I didn't get here until 1972, but he's one person I'd definitely have liked to have met.
I met him briefly, but again, that's through my own relatives and a lot of the people who I met when I came here first. I came in 59. Because of his character, because of his accent, because of his approach, you know, was mocked by many. However, it did change. You know, the course of of labor history, or I should say it continued, because, you know, we go back, as you have, you know, covered very well, the labor and the Irish of labor history. Just if you could give us, a little synopsis, again, going to this, starting with that Peter Maguire. He was not a huge leader. He was kind of an itinerant worker who, you know, he wasn't anything in particular. How did he become?
Well, he became a breadwinner for the family at 11, you know, and while his father was off fighting with the Union Army, and then afterwards he made his living as an itinerant carpenter, traveling around the country, and he eventually came to co-found the American Federation of Labor, and he was the first one to actually propose a day honoring from rude nature has delved and carved all of the grandeur we behold. So to honor those people, the laborers, you know. So,
but how did he make inroads? You know, as somebody who would be considered, you know, kind of a lone ranger without much opportunity to take his working background and turn it into something.
Well, it's kind of interesting. I suppose you have to kind of look at the Civil War, where the Irish were finally, after what they did in the Civil War, were finally gaining some acceptance, you know. And so you had some of that leadership that came out of the Civil War, like Thomas Maher and people like that, especially in New York, you had a lot of that. And so I think that, to be honest with you, I think somebody should do a documentary and tell us more about him, because I don't know much more than really what we have.
Definitely worth researching. The labor movement and the history of the labor movement in Ireland, was there any correlation there, you know, with respect to what was going on here, or was there any?
Well, there certainly was, with people like Mike Quill, who had been in the IRA and stuff like that, and was influenced by Connolly and the socialist movement, and you know, so definitely, I think that the whole labor movement and Ireland has stayed connected over the years, you know. So there's a big back and forth. I mean, Terry O'Sullivan.
Sure.
Definitely involved.
Trish, if I were to, you know, even list some of the accolades that you've received, I'm not sure where to start, other than saying that I'm, you know, the Presidential Distinguished Service Award, you know, for the Irish Abroad from President Higgins, that had to be for, you know, last year. That has to rank pretty high.
That was really something, Adrian. I have to say, it was really pretty amazing. I couldn't believe it. You know, I'm still have to pinch myself. Yeah. It was only the second time I'd ever been in Arsenal, and the first time was when Mary Robinson was president, and I'd nervously gone over there to interview her. Yeah. And actually, what I remember about that time is then I went up to Belfast, and I was staying with a friend of mine from Derry. And she said to me, "Och, you better go and interview Gerry Adams." And this was 1991. I was like, really? So I did, actually, because she set it up, and it was very interesting, because back then he talked about the need for a political solution, time for talks, and, you know, it was all very nice. So,
you know,
it's been quite a ride, quite a journey. And, you know, of course, I met Neil O'Dowd all those years ago out in San Francisco when he had the Irishman newspaper. So it's quite. He deserves great credit for all of this.
And you also, of course. This being the fifth anniversary of the Nobel Prize-winning poet Seamus Heaney, interviewing Heaney. That has to rank pretty high, you know.
Oh, that was amazing for me. It was an amazing opportunity, and of course that he was at NYU, so Glaxman Ireland House founded around then. So that's probably how that came about. I remember it was his birthday, April 13th, 1996. So it was just after a couple of months after the Nobel Prize, and I met him in Washington Square Park. And knowing that it was his birthday, I just brought him some daffodils, and then we went back to his apartment. And I have this abiding memory of seeing Seamus Heaney, this Nobel Prize winner, getting a jar to put these daffodils in and running the water over by the sink. And the thing about Seamus Heaney is that he was always really interested in everybody else. So,
yeah.
He always wanted to know more about you, and he just always loved the common man, and he just seemed huddled in a corner talking to a doorman, or, you know, he was just such a wonderful man.
How, say somebody, and I don't know if you had met him before that, but what were your first impressions, say, of Heaney? Did he look like somebody, you know, who might be a poet? If you had to guess, you know, what his line of work was, what was it?
Well, you know, I love his early poems, and there's this one poem where he talks about his father digging the sod and watching his father. And, of course, he had those farmer's roots and those farmer's hands, and he had in that a line in that poem that says, "But this is my pen, and I'll dig with that," you know?
Yeah.
So he was really very much connected to the soil, and he looked like that, you know? He looked like somebody...
Yes.
You could easily see him in that rural setting, you know? Hair a little wild, just mainly... He never, ever, ever came across as, you know, the... We all know he was just... so highly educated and all of that. He just always came across as just a very ordinary man, if you get my meaning.
Yes.
I mean, he was extraordinary, but he always came to me, and I mean, I was lucky enough to meet him.
Yeah.
He would always immediately ask you how you were, you know, and try and take the conversation into what was happening with you. And
I wonder if on either side of the Atlantic, whether he was, you know, appreciated, or was he kind of one more poet, okay? And that actually, when he got the Nobel, Peace Prize, did we then recognize, oh, God, he's been around, you know, he's been around for a while.
Oh, well, you know, you have to be dead to be Irish and appreciate it, you know.
Well, at least he made it before that.
But it's interesting, there was all this taboo about Edna O'Brien becoming a dame and accepting the OBE from the British, but it's like we've never really honored her in Ireland, and that's what I actually loved about the presidential awards, that finally... And finally, the diaspora and people who have had to leave Ireland are being recognized by the Irish government. And it's really, really, really important. And going back to me again, but there were so many great people there. There was a man from Japan who was honored. There was somebody from Argentina. There was this nurse from Cork who had worked all over, you know, third world countries. So it was meeting these people from all over the world who had still had this connection. You know, you're born in Ireland. It's always going to be your home. You go out, and in my case, there wasn't very much happening in 1972 in Ireland. And, you know, there's always the spirit of adventure, which other than economic reasons kind of lead you to leave. Yeah, I think it's wonderful that they're finally sort of looking at the diaspora and have an appreciation for it. And in terms of Heaney, I don't know. I think in the end he probably was appreciated, you know. Sometimes other people have to honor you before our own appreciated, so maybe the Nobel Prize did that for him. But I think he didn't care one way or the other. I think he was a poet, and that's what he did. And you know, also the thing about Seamus Heaney, his wife Mari is such a wonderful writer. She did a great book which people should get on Amazon. It's been out a long time now, but it's called Over Nine Waves, which covers all of the mythology of Ireland, and it's really wonderfully written. So I think maybe we'll be hearing more from her in the coming years. I hope so.
Trish, again, thank you for joining us on this Labor Day weekend, and again to remind us that, you know, we, as you began your article, you know, in your coverage on the Irish Labor contribution, say, okay, we associate very much Labor Day with, you know, maybe rolling out the last barbecue of the season without giving it much, you know, thought beyond that.
Right.
Thanks,
Adrian. And listen, if anybody out there wants to sign up for our weekly newsletter, which is really gathering steam now, just go on our website, irishamerica.com, and you'll get these stories every weekend for
every
your weekend.
Every weekend,
reading, so.
And it's, you know, and aptly, you know, it is for weekend reading, and it is great because you get, I'm not surprised it is taking off because indeed it's great.
Well, we have 33 years of archives now. We want to get it out there, so lots of stories. And what good is a story, Adrian, if people can't read it or talk about it? So thank you for all your work over the years and for always being such a great partner with us and for keeping the story going, really.
Well, I thank you for that, but obviously, you know, not that let's not get into a mutual admiration society here, but what we have at a time when, you know, most people would think the day of print is over, you know, the internet, social media has taken over, that does not apply to a magazine as unique as Irish American Magazine.
Thank you. And you know, I have two kids now. One who's fourth generation. They wouldn't like me calling them kids. Two assistant editors. Dave Luce, who's down in Philadelphia at the Irish Games this weekend, who's doing great podcasts. He's fourth generation, and he started his own hurling team a couple of years ago. And then Mary Gallagher just graduated from Molloy, put the newsletter together, and certainly a couple of generations removed, and just amazing. So, you know, Irish America goes on.
Irish America indeed goes on, and I don't think we should, the whole notion, again, that social media has taken over everything, I think that's greatly exaggerated. And if we go back, to all of those years, go back to, you know, to 85, I was already 15 years by then on radio. And even before going into radio, word was, Asher, that's, that's never going to last. That's only a hobby. What the hell are you doing with that for?
Who do you think you are?
But you get a day job for yourself and smarten up. At the time that Neil O'Dowd and yourself were introducing, you know, a magazine, a glossy magazine, one would have said, I'm sure the same people would have said, are you kidding me? Who's going to? And first of all, you know, how is that going to be distributed and have interest across America? Because we were, maybe it's because we're on the East Coast, but we thought that Irish America, you know, kind of, if you got outside metropolitan New York, there'd be few and far between after that. It's amazing that over those years when everybody said, God be with the Irish, and when New York was Irish, and all of the songs at the time would indicate it was an end of an era. And here we are.
Yeah, there we are. We're still here.
Okay.
Keep on keeping on, Adrian.
Yeah, listen, there is a song, and again, you wouldn't probably remember this, and if you do, for some reason, I dare you, follow the lyrics, but it is a song that even we in the west of Ireland grew up with, and it's called Tipperary Daisy. So from the Nina girl.
And Teddy Gleason.
Oh, yes. Okay.
Who's Nina.
Nina. Oh, that's
Nina,
right.
The old labor movement.
That's right. Well, anyway, here's I'm going to And as a matter of fact, I'm in the program with this song.
Thanks so much, Adrian. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, but I want to dedicate this song to you. It's called Tipperary Daisy.
Oh.
Thank you.
I'm in love with a typical tip, typical Tipperary miss. She's a darling young slip with a rosy lip that you dearly love to kiss. From the tip of her coat to the tip-top of her nose, I love her so. I'd just like to take her and squeeze her, for I know that it wouldn't displease her. She lives in Tipperary, many miles away from here. I'd just like to meet her and see her and greet her. I'm sure I could eat her the sweet little dear. She lives so very far away, I'd have to wait a year. Till I take a notion to sail on the ocean to Ireland. Say, this me that's nearly crazy. For me, Tipperary Daisy. Well, the thing I find that is on me mind is the darling girl I left behind. Far off, in dear old Tipperary.